everybody. Before I start the lecture today, I'd like to mention that I'm going to be giving a one-class lecture, which I scheduled for June 1st, that's a week from Friday, on Henry Hazlitt's book, Foundations of Morality. If I'm not mistaken, Danny can correct me, but I think there won't be any charge for this lecture, so anyone who wants to hear it will be able to listen to it. But that's a week from Friday. Now, today we're going to be talking about Marxism, which was one of the most influential of all doctrines. It hasn't been doing too well since the collapse of the Soviet Union, but this is an extremely important both economic and historical point of view that was extremely influential, and there are still plenty of Marxists around. As you know, if you've done the reading in Rothbard's History of Economic Thought, he has a great deal to say on Marxism. And we're not going to be able to cover it all in this lecture. But what I want to concentrate on in this lecture is Marx's theory of history, which is usually called historical materialism, and also some points in his economic theory. Rothbard devotes a great deal of attention to Marx's philosophy, which is what Marx's relation, Marx's system to Hegel's philosophy, and he considers them both, I think, of a pseudo-religion, has these following various writers like Eric Bogren and Thomas Molnar, who interpret Marxism as a really kind of secularized version of certain heretical movements in theology. Now, if you want to, we can get into that in the discussion if you want, but that's not what I'm going to be concentrating on in this lecture. I simply did that because I think we need to, if I talk about the theory of history, Marxist historical materialism, and economics, that'll be more than enough for one lecture. Now, Marx was unusual among economists. Most economists just have a theory of how the economy works, but they don't claim. Some economists have talked about historical developments, like Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations was one, but generally economists don't have a worked out theory that's supposed to explain the whole course of history, but Marx did. He was a very comprehensive thinker, and he had an account of history that he thought he could really explain the basic underlying factors that were determining historical development. He didn't claim to be able to predict every single event, but he thought there were historical laws that would explain the main trends in history. And in particular, he says that history is determined by the growth of the forces of production. So throughout history, the forces of production have a tendency to grow, and this is the single most important factor that determines the course of history. That other things like the social system and the ideas that are present in a particular society depend on the force of production. Now, obviously, if you think that, it's very important to know what did Marx mean by the force of production. If you say, well, the force of production is the main causal factor in history, you'd better know what the force of production refers to. But unfortunately, Marx doesn't really give any exact definitions of forces of production. So we know the force of production determined history, but we don't know exactly what he means by that. But there are different interpretations. But one of the most plausible view, I think, is supported by a lot of textual evidence, is he meant something like the technology that exists at a particular time. So just as, say, in the Industrial Revolution, we had development of new use of steam power and water power. So that technology would shape the way capitalism developed. And similarly, for other points in history, the state of technology at the time that would determine how history is going. So the force of production, the main thing. And when Rothbard, Murray Rothbard, gives this account of Marx's theory of history, it says it's the forces of production that are the main causal factor of history. He's following Ludwig von Mises in Mises' interpretation of Marx's theory of history. Theory of History, which is in Mises' book, Theory and History. Many of you, I'm sure, will have come across that book or read it. So Rothbard, in what he says about Marx's theory of history, is following Mises in saying that the development of force production is the main cause of factor. So he's saying, really, Marx's theory of history is a kind of technological determinism. And Mises was relying in his interpretation of Marx's theory of history in this respect on a book by the great Russian Marxist G.V. Plekhanov, which is called The Development of a Monist View of History, which came out in 1895. This is one of the seminal works of Russian Marxism. And I should mention, there's a very good book by the British political philosopher, he's sometime Marxist, G.A. Cohen, called Karl Marx's Theory of History, The Defense, that also follows this interpretation of the Plekhanov view that Marx is really a technological determinant. There are some people who don't go along with this, just stress more just the class struggle aspects of Marxism, but this is the interpretation that Rothbard favors. So how is it that the force of production or the technology is the main causal factor in history? How does it bring about all these other important things in history? Well, the basic point is, as the force of production developed, in the Marxist view, the forces of production technology always increasing, always getting better. Say, people today have much greater and more highly developed technology than, say, we had in the Middle Ages or in the Stone Age. So there's continual progress in technology. So as the force of production developed, they determine what Marx calls the relation of production. Now again, we have a bit of a problem in explaining the Marxist system, because Marx doesn't clearly define relations of production either. So we have, first he says, the forces of production determine the relations of production, and he's not really clear, very exact, in how he defines either term. So we're going to have some problems in understanding the theory. But what relations of production basically means is the way the process of production is organized. Say something like, today we have a basically capitalist system. We have production is organized in private firms. There's a good deal of government intervention but we have a free market, so it's a capitalist type of organization of production, and this would be an example of the relations of production. It's the way production is organized. And what Marx tended to stress when he was describing relation production were the division into classes in the way production is organized. Say, today we have people who are workers and there are other people who are owning the places of employment. So it's the basic division under capitalism between the capitalists and workers. So what Marx is looking for in each of these social systems, each of these systems in which production is organized, is what are the basic economic classes in each system. So that's what's included in the relation production. And part of what would be included in relation production would be the legal relationships among people. Say, if you're an owner of a factory, say, you have certain legal rights over the property. And if you're a worker, say you don't, you can't just come in normally and say, well, I don't like the way my employer is running things, so we're going to kick him out. The workers are going to take over. The society will have certain laws defining the relationships of various people, various groups, classes in the production process, and giving their legal rights and duties. So this is included in the relation production, these legal relations. So we have, again, the technology, the forces of production that determine the relations of production. The relation production is the way production is organized, including the conflict, the various classes that are engaged in production, their legal relation. Now, it's also the case, according to Marx, that every society has a system of beliefs which is based on the interests of the ruling class that supports the way production is organized. Now, to understand this, we have to see first, Marx not only thought that society was organized into classes, he thought these classes were in conflict with each other. He says in the Communist Manifesto, one of his most famous works he wrote with Friedrich Engels, was published in 1848, he says, very famous sentence, the history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggle. So we have in each society their conflicting classes, and there's a system of beliefs that prevails in society which supports the way production is the interests of the ruling class. And the system will justify the way production is organized. For example, in our capitalist society, there's an ideology that's basically in favor of the market. There are people today who want all sorts of intervention in the market, but basically, most people favor today, in the United States today, favor some kind of market system. So Marx would say, well, the reason for that is that the ruling class finds that the market is in its interest, so it's able to establish a system of beliefs that are favorable to the market as the ruling ideology. Now, what do we mean by ideology? Remember, from the previous lecture, the word, I think, was coined by Destin Petrassi, the French right of fringe classical liberal, but the way Marx was using ideology would be the system would imply the system of beliefs wasn't aiming at the truth, say what the system of beliefs was trying to do was to justify the rule of the ruling class in this whole system of beliefs. Marx calls it part of the superstructure. There's the underlying fact, the force of production, relation of production, and then there's a superstructure. So superstructure is really caused by the under other factors. It isn't that the superstructure exercise comes first. You first have the way society is organized, and then you have a system of beliefs that's trying to justify the position of the ruling class. And it's not aiming at the truth, it's ideological. Now, this view raises a problem for Marx's own theory, which is, suppose you say that the system of beliefs about society is ideological and isn't aiming at the truth. Well, Marxism itself is a system of beliefs that's supposed to promote the interests of the working class. So if you hold that all systems of belief, the social systems of belief are ideological in the sense that it's not aiming at the truth, would it follow that Marxism itself is an ideological system and it's not aiming at the truth, it's just aiming at the interest of helping the interest of a particular class? And so the question would be, is Marxism ideological too? I see there's a question from the lead. So the first objection also determines superstructure. Yes, that would be the underlying determinant. Remember, the determination would go through the relation of production. It wouldn't be the forces that are directly determining the ideology. The forces are determining the relation of production, so the relations of production of what's being the superstructure is supposed to justify the relations of production, particularly the position of the ruling class. So see, the problem would be if Marx's own theory is ideological, it's not aiming at the truth, well, why should we believe it? Why should we think it's true if it doesn't even claim to aim at the truth? So it's system threatens to be self-undermining. I'm not clear, maybe to discuss it in the discussion period, how Marx could get out of that. Maybe Marxists could say it doesn't matter what the motives are of the people. Advancing the theory, that you could just look at the theory independently and try to determine whether it's true, but if we could do that, then if we can look at theories independently of whether what their class interests are promoting, that would threaten to undermine the whole point that it's their use in supporting the system production that accounts for ideology. People could really become detached from the system sufficient to evaluate it objectively. That would weaken considerably the claim that it's the relations of production that determine the ideology. The superstructure isn't something that has an independent, can be independently evaluated. Then maybe it isn't so dependent on the relations of production. So there's a problem for Marx here. Now, supposing we have this, then we have the force production, determined relations of production, and we have a superstructure on top of that. So how does history proceed under this system? Well, we mentioned before, the forces of production have a tendency to grow continually. So the technology is always developing. We're always getting more and better machines. Maybe there could be temporary setbacks, but the general trend is upward. So Marx thinks the relations of production, the social system that adopted at a particular time, are those that are best suited to develop the force of production at that time. So in various stages of history, there'll be a particular type of social system, particular relations of production that will be the system best suited to develop the forces of production at that time. But as the force of production continue to grow, the system that used to be the best one to develop the force of production will stop being the best system. So if you look at the ancient world, Greek and Roman history, slavery, according to Marx, was the best way to develop the force of production, given the technology they had available to them. But then when conditions changed, the old system, the system of slavery, wasn't the one that was best suited to develop the force of production. So he says the old system becomes fetters and chains on the development of the force of production. So it used to be the best system, the system that would develop the force of production, but now it's impeding progress. It's blocking the development of the forces of production. So the systems, when I mentioned these various systems, the ways of production, the main ones are slavery, which is in the ancient world, then we have feudalism in the Middle Ages, and capitalism in the modern world. In each of these systems is characterized by class conflict. In slavery, obviously, you have the conflict between the slaves and the owners. In feudalism, similarly, you have a conflict between the serfs, the peasants who were required to stay on the manors and work the land, and the lords. And in capitalism, there's a conflict between the capitalist owners and the workers. So each of these systems is characterized by class conflict. And this is, Marx is referring to these systems when he said that statement I quoted before from the manifesto, the history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class conflict. Now, there's also an initial stage, which isn't part of history proper, part of prehistory, where the Marx thought there was an initial stage where there wasn't class conflict, where everyone owned things in common. This is called the stage of primitive communism. The main Marxist who wrote on that was Marx's collaborator Friedrich Engels. And so Engels and Marx thought before history gets started, there's a preliminary stage where the tribes or small groups would own everything in common. They principally got this idea from the American anthropologist Lewis Henry Morgan, and it's been much disputed by anthropologists subsequent to Marx. But this is the main thing to remember, though, is that history after primitive communism is characterized by these systems where there is conflict among the main economic groups. Now, Marx also at least sometimes recognized another system, which is called the Asiatic mode of production. Say this was found, say, in ancient China and maybe in some other places like the Inca Empire in Peru. And this system would involve slavery but there'd be a highly centralized system under a monarch, and there'd be many local villages, and be a high centralized system. And according to Marx, when he wrote about the Asiatic mode of production, there would be particular economic features of society that would make this system possible and determine its main features. And this, in particular, was centralized control of water and irrigation. So we could call these societies ones of hydraulic despotism. There's a very interesting writer named Karl Wittfogel, who was a German Marxist who was very influential in the 1930s and 40s, who wrote about the Asiatic mode of production. Then he came to America, became very anti-communist. He firmly been a member of the German Communist Party and turned very much the other way. He wrote a book in 1957 called Oriental Despotism, which was on the Asiatic mode of production. He used this mode to analyze the current communist rule. So he said a lot of the communist rule will parallel, very well explained by the model Marx had for the Asiatic mode of production. So naturally, this wasn't very popular among supporters of the communist regime, because Wittfogel was saying, well, look, you're supposed to be revolutionary socialist systems, but you're really just recreating Oriental despotism. Now, in the Marxist view, as I said, we have the systems, ancient slavery, feudalism, in Catholicism, each one is characterized by class conflict. But then there's going to be a future system which is called socialism or communism. And this will be established through a revolution. The workers or the proletariat will rise up and destroy the capitalist system. And in the new system, there'll be a period which is called the dictatorship of the proletariat, which will stamp out opposition. And after that, there won't be any class conflict. So unlike in capitalism, feudalism, and slavery, we won't have conflicting economic groups. There'll just be, everyone will be the same group. Everyone will get along because there won't be economic conflict. Now, what do we mean when we say dictatorship of the proletariat? We think today of a dictator as something like, in some countries there's a single person who's the absolute ruler. So you wonder, well, how can you talk about the dictatorship of the proletariat if the proletariat is a whole class? But we have to realize when Marx spoke of dictatorship, he was using dictatorship in the sense it has in Roman law. Now, in Roman law, the dictator wasn't an absolute ruler. It doesn't just mean absolute ruler. A dictator was someone who was given temporary power to suspend all the laws because of an emergency. So, supposing, say, the city Rome was under attack, so somebody could be appointed dictator, and then he'd be able to, in order to defend the city, be able to suspend all the regular laws, do what he wanted, but this would just be for a temporary period. He wouldn't be made permanent. He wouldn't be, meaning that he would be the permanent absolute ruler, he'd just be dictator for a temporary period. So the phrase dictatorship of the proletariat is intended to suggest that when capitalism is overthrown, we need to have a period when we're suspending the laws in order to smash the capitalist resistance to the revolution. So, and the capitalists couldn't say, well, you can't just deprive us of our rights. If you have a dictatorship in this sense, you can, because you need these emergency measures to suppress all resistance. So, to say, in the Marxist view, we're going to have a socialist revolution, and then there won't be any more class conflict. Now, as you might suspect, the way I've taught about the theory, Mises and Rothbard didn't like this theory very much. And they have a great many penetrating criticisms of it. Now, one of the most serious criticisms of the Marxist theory, which both Mises and Rothbard make, is that the fundamental assumption of the Marxist theory is flawed. Remember, Marx said that the forces of production, the growth and force production, are the main determinant of the course of history. The forces of production, they're growing, and then you have relations of production that be determined by the growth and the force of production. But, well, what's wrong with it? Well, the force of production, if you mean by that technology, isn't something that just grows by itself. It isn't as if there's some kind of machine. You can imagine, say, machines just building themselves and getting bigger and better by themselves. Remember, only individuals act, only people act. If machines don't act by themselves, it's people who create machines, who invent them, create the machine. So, if that's right, it's a basic principle in Austrian economics or praxeology, it's called methodological individualism, only individuals act. So, if it's the case that only individuals act, then the growth in the force of production depends on the ideas that people have. If people don't come up with ideas for new inventions, then we're not going to have a growth in the force of production. So it isn't as Marx thinks that the force of production is developing by themselves, and then this is creating relation production, this creating the superstructure. It's the growth, the force production depends on the ideas people have, and it also depends on institutional legal relations. Say, if you have, say, a free market, this will be very conducive to innovation and change. So, how the force production develops will depend on the ideas people have and what the institutions of society are and what legal relations are. So what's really wrong then with the basis of the Marxist view, which is that the force of production determined the course of history, is that Marx has the direction of causation wrong. Marx says that it's the force of production will cause changes in the relation of production, but it's just the other way around. Changes in the way society is organized will encourage or impede changes in the force of production. So it's the ideas people have and the way people are organized that, according to Mises and Rothbard, determine how technology will develop. It isn't that technology is some sort of independent force that's self-sustaining, and then that explains the course of history. So Marx has the direction of causation wrong. Now, even if you put that point aside, which I think is a fundamental point that really knocks out the whole system, suppose you just take Marx's system as it stands, and sometimes it's a very good idea when you're looking at a particular theory, instead of trying just to criticize it from other points of view that you might hold, it's a good idea to try to look at the theory and say, what are some of the internal problems of the theory? So the criticism I just gave, it says that development force deduction depend on ideas, isn't an internal criticism. That's saying, look, one of the assumptions of the theory is incorrect, one of the main doctrine theories wrong, that kind of external criticism. But there are also criticisms that operate just within the theory itself. One is that in Marx's view, the forces of production are supposed to determine the relations of production. But Marx doesn't really explain how this happens. How is it supposed to be, say, that a particular invention such as the handmill can bring about an entire social system? Sometimes we can have the same type of invention in different, and we have different social systems that use them. So why should we think, well, one example Rothbard gives, he said Lenin in Great Russian Beauty once said, electricity will bring about socialism. Why would just having this particular kind of technology determine the social system? Now, one thing, both and Marx said, well, the way this process of determination takes place is we just say, what system would best be fitted to develop the course for production at a particular time? But if that's what the question is, wouldn't the answer be that the free market capitalism, is always the system that would best develop the technology available at the time? So, say, even though technology during the time of the Roman Empire was much less advanced than it is today, it doesn't follow that it was more productive for the Romans to have slavery than it would have been if they had a free market system. We know from economic theory the free market system is the most productive way to organize things. That isn't something that varies from one time to another. So if you want to say Marx is wrong to think that at different times, there are different social systems that are suited best to develop the force of production. It would always be a capitalist system. Now, as I mentioned, another very important part of Marxism is the doctrine of class conflict. This is basic when you're thinking about the relation of production. And what's important for capitalism is the division of two classes, which is the bourgeoisie, or the capitalist, and the proletariat, or the worker. And Rothbard, in responding to this, said, well, why should these be the only two classes that matter? There are all sorts of ways people can be classified. You could take smaller economic groups like people in, say, who were in the retail business, or people who make one particular type of good, all the clothes manufacturers, all the grocery store makers, so on. Why is it just workers and capitalists who are the only classes? Why just these two? And then a further point is, once you've got a particular class, economic class, why should you assume that someone would follow his class interest over his individual interest or the interest of his family or other interests that he might have? Marx seems to take for granted that the class interests that are the most important factors in influencing what an individual will do. But again, why do we have to take the particular classes Marx is interested in, and aside from that, why do we have to assume that it's the economic classes at all that are the main thing, factors that are motivating the individuals to act. Now, Rothbard makes an even deeper criticism of Marx on class. He points out that in the free market, the relations between capitalists aren't antagonistic. I mean, it might be that particular workers don't like their bosses very much, but there isn't any fundamental antagonism. In what sense? What I mean by that? Well, in the free market, people will engage in economic exchange because each one will think that he will benefit from such an exchange. So if you go to work for somebody, you think you'd rather get, you if the person's offered you, I'll give you so much money for working for me, you think you'll do that because you think you'd rather have that money and do the work for him than not have the money and not work for him. Similarly, the employer would rather think he can get something he values what you'll be producing for him more than the money he's giving you in salary. So in the free market, people are benefiting from mutual exchange. So how do you get really antagonistic class relationships? That would be, according to the Rothbard, only when the state enables one group to prey on another, like PREY, to take advantage of them or to exploit them, not PRAY. So what you have really, if one group can use the state to the predatory instrument of predation, that would be a system of castes rather than economic classes. It would be a system legally defined relations where some people don't have to rely on free mutually beneficial exchanges but can just take things from other people. And this libertarian theory of class, were saying that the contrasting classes, economic classes based on mutually beneficial exchange and antagonistic relationships which are based on predation, were developed by the French classical liberals early 19th century, Charles Comte, Charles Dumoyer, and Augustin Thierry. They were, Ralph Rachel was written quite a lot about the school of French classical liberals. Now Marx was familiar with this theory, and he sometimes used it, for example, in his pamphlet, The 18th Brumaire, which was on an account of the way Napoleon III took over power and overthrew the French Republic that had been established after the Revolution of 1848, that expelled, that got rid of the Orleanist monarchy under King Louis Philippe, the Republic, which lasted, it began 1848, then 1850, and Louis Napoleon was elected president, and he overthrew the Republic and established the Second Empire. So Marx used this type of class analysis where you talk about how groups use the government to get special privileges for themselves in the 18th Brumaire, but this wasn't his main focus, but he was aware of this theory. In the 20th century, Franz Oppenheimer and Albert J. Nock extended this theory. They applied it, say Nock applied it to explaining the American history and explaining economic interests in the American Constitution. So this is the libertarian theory. It says class conflict depends, is really caste conflict depends on predatory relations that involve the use of the state and the economic relations in a free market are not antagonistic. Now, one interesting point Rothbard makes, he follows the author Robert Tucker, who was an expert mainly on Russian history, in saying that Marx realized that when capitalism was overthrown, the initial situation would be worse than it was under capitalism. This is called, Marx called this raw communism. So what would happen when we have this overthrow of capitalism, things wouldn't be very good at first because workers would be dominated by envy. They want to take over other people's possessions. There'd be all sorts of hostile feelings. So the initial period wouldn't be very good at all. Now, this isn't a very good way to sell socialist revolution, so this hasn't gotten much emphasis in later. Marx didn't say very much about this after he mentioned this in his very early manuscript, and subsequent Marxists haven't mentioned it either. Now, we now want to get into some of the particulars of Marx's economic theory. He had this theory where he explained where he had these various social systems, and he was particularly interested, in, of course, in analyzing capitalism. And his analysis of capitalism depends on the labor theory of value. And we explained the labor theory when we were discussing Ricardo, but now I want to go into more detail about what Marx's arguments were on the labor theory. Well, Marx says, suppose you have two commodities that are being exchanged, like I'm growing some apples and I want to exchange them for your oranges. So he says, well, when there's an exchange, there has to be an equality between the two commodities. So any exchange proposes an equality. So we have one apple is exchanged for two oranges. I mean, you can say one apple equals two oranges. So we say exchange implies that there's equality, but we have to then say, well, what is it that's equal? Well, it can't be in what Marx calls a use value, which is roughly, but not entirely the same as utility of a commodity. Because if you take what the utility of the commodity, that just varies with the individual. There could be all sorts of things why people want an orange or why people want an apple. Could have all sorts of different uses for people. So it would make sense to say that the use value of an apple, say, is equal to the use value of two oranges. So it has to be something else that's equal. So Marx said, well, if they're equal, they have to be equal to something else. And he thinks that the third thing, what they have to be equal to, can only be labor. So his argument is, if you have exchange, there has to be an equality of what exchanged, and this equality has to be something they're both equal to, so and this can only be labor. So the value of a commodity depends on the number of labor hours required to produce it. So why, say my example, suppose it's the case that one apple equals two oranges, why would they exchange in that proportion, one apple equals two oranges? Because it would take in the same amount of time it took you to produce one apple, you would be able to produce two oranges. So that's what how you would get that relationship, one apple equals two oranges. Now, I don't think it'll be much of a surprise. There are a great many problems with the labor sharing value. And the most, one of the most important of these is that Marx was wrong to say an exchange requires equality between the two commodities that are traded. When you exchange, why are you engaging in exchange? Because you want what you're getting more than what you're giving up. If I trade, I have an apple, and I trade you for two oranges, I'd rather have the two oranges than the apple, otherwise I wouldn't trade you an apple for two oranges. And you'd rather have an apple than the two oranges you're giving me for the apple. So each exchange involves a double inequality. Each person is valuing what he gets more than what he gives up. Now, Marx could respond to that. He said, well, all right, you do have this double inequality in utility or use value, but you also have an equality as well. It has to be an equality as well in something else. But that's just superfluous. You don't need to postulate that to explain value and prices. You can do explain values just on the basis of the double inequality. So you don't need to assume the equality that Marx did. You don't need to say if commodities are exchanged, then it has to, they have to be equal to something. Now, suppose you did think that, suppose you said equality, commodities exchange has to be, two commodities have to be equal. It wouldn't follow the equality has to be one of labor. What if it were, say, some kind of units of energy, or we could think of perhaps other things that could be equal. Marx doesn't seem to have any really good argument that if there is an equality, it has to be equality of labor. Now, there are a whole lot of other problems with the labor theory also. One is that some labor is much more efficient than other labor. Suppose it takes me longer to make a bookcase than it would take a trained carpenter to make the bookcase. It doesn't follow that my bookcase would be worth more because I put more labor into it. It actually reminds me, this example I put this in, it reminds me of a story when I was in junior high school, which was a long time ago. We had to take these shop courses. There was wood shop, electric shop, print shop. I wasn't very good at those sort of things. So I remember in the wood shop course, we had two projects. We had to make a bookend and a lamp, and I think we had about a 20-week semester. So about the 16th week, the teacher in the course said, someone said, well, everybody will pass the course, unless, of course, there's some deadbeat, unless there's some deadbeat who's still working on his bookend. And I was just getting started on my bookend at the time. Somehow I managed to get through. I think he had mercy on me. But in any event, you can see that there's a problem for the labor theory if you say, well, some types of people are much better at producing things than other people. And then there'd be a further problem is how could you compare different kinds of labor? Say, supposing you're comparing, say, the work of a carpenter with the work of a surgeon. They're doing very different kinds of labor, so how could you just compare, say, well, it takes the surgeon, say, 3 hours to do the big operation. Would this be the same, would he get the same amount as a carpenter would for working 3 hours on something else? Doesn't seem like that would work out. Now, Marx answered the first point that some people are much better at doing certain kinds of doing labor than others by saying it isn't just anybody's labor that counts. It's a socially necessary labor time required to produce a commodity that determines its value. And by socially necessary, meant something like the average time. So my bookcase wouldn't be worth more than the bookcase is more efficiently produced, so it would just be the socially necessary time. And on the problem of different kinds of labor, Marx said, well, we can compare these different kinds of labor by using the market, because they suppose a surgeon, say, earns three times as much as a carpenter, then you could say, an hour of a surgeon's work is worth 3 hours of a carpenter's work. So we can kind of get a measure of different kinds of labor by seeing what their wages are. But the problem is with these solutions is these are circular solutions, because to get the socially necessary labor time and to get how the different types of labor to be compared, we have to use money wages. But the labor theory is supposed to explain market prices. But here it's presupposing that we have market prices in order to compare different kinds of labor and see what socially necessary labor time is. So it's really using what it's supposed to explain. So it's supposed to explain prices, including wages, but it's using prices, particular prices, to figure out how different labor units are being compared. Now, why did Marx stress the labor theory of value so much? Why did he put such emphasis on it? Well, he thought that the labor theory was the means for understanding what he called the laws of motion of capitalism. Remember, laws of motion, this is a term from Isaac Newton, where he's trying to explain the laws of motion of the whole universe. So Marx was very ambitious. He said, well, I can give the laws of motion for capitalism. So what he particularly wanted to explain is this, that the capitalist is starting with a certain amount of money. And then when he has it, he'll buy or rent land, labor, machinery, what he needs to engage in production. And then he sells what he produces. So if he didn't make a mistake, he'll earn some return, he'll earn a profit. So what Marx says is he starts with a certain amount of money, so he has M, certain amount of money. Then he converts this money into commodities, land, labor, machinery. Then he sells the product and gets more money than he started with. So what Marx was asking for, how is MCM prime? So how does this increase come about? How is it that capitalists are able to earn a return? And the answer that Marx came up with, he said, well, what is the worker selling the capitalist? Suppose you say someone hires, say, someone to work at McDonald's. What is the person giving in return for the wage? According to Marx, he's giving his labor power. What does this mean? That the capitalist is getting a certain number of hours of labor time. And during this time, the worker can produce goods of economic value for the employer. Probably McDonald's isn't the best example to fit, because that's a service, let's think, instead of something like where somebody's producing, say, working in a factory. So remember, according to labor theory of value, the value of the goods is dependent on the number of labor hours in the goods. So what the capitalist is getting a certain number of labor hours by employing the worker, and this will enable economic value to be produced just because economic value is consists of labor hours that result in production. So the profit comes in because the capitalist doesn't pay the worker the full labor value of what the labor produces. What is he paying instead? Well, to answer that, you have to say, go to labor theory of value and say, what would labor be paid according to the labor theory of value? So he's applying the labor theory. We know the value of commodities depends on the labor hours required to produce a particular commodity. So we say the value of an apple would be how much labor would it require to grow an apple. So how can this theory be applied to get the value of labor? Well, according to Marx, this is the labor cost required to produce the worker's labor power. So according to Marx, just like the cost of commodity is what's the labor required to produce what's required to produce the worker's labor power is the labor cost required to produce that. So the labor is giving a certain number of hours to the employer. So what does it cost to enable the laborer to give those hours to the employer? So put this more simply, the worker is paid what's required for the laborer to live. So by paying the worker what's required for him to live, the capitalist is getting the use of all these hours of labor, and using these hours of labor is what's enabling him to get a profit, because the amount that he's getting, that the worker is adding to economic value by labor, will be greater than the labor what's required to, the amount required to enable the labor to live. So in other words, in this theory, labor is earning a subsistence wage. Labor is earning just what's required to enable it to live. So Rothbard contends that when Marx says this, you have to take it very strictly, in a very strict literal sense, that Marx thinks that workers are just getting the minimum required for them to live. And if you take it that way, the theory is obviously false, because workers don't just get a minimum, at least many workers don't just get a minimum for what's required to live, they get a lot more than that. So you take Marx's entering his subsistence theory of wages, which he seems to need in order to explain profit, then it seems like that theory is obviously empirically false. So, if this is how profit arises, you say profit arises because the capitalist is paying the worker a subsistence wage, just what is required for the worker to live, but in return, he gets the worker's labor power so he can use all these labor hours to produce goods of economic value. So then the rate of profit would depend just on how much labor is employed, because you get economic value depending on the number of labor hours that are added, that you're using to produce the commodity. So that determines that's where your profit is coming from. So additions to capital, say just adding more machines, aren't going to add to profit. You can see, why not? Well, because machines, you're getting, if a capitalist can certainly use a machine to produce more, but he'll have to pay the full value, expected value of the machine when he does that. If the markets are working properly, then the owners of the machine that the capitalist is buying will take fully into account how much that machine is going to add to production. So if the capitalist won't be able to earn a return on the machinery, he'll have to pay. That'll all be taken care of in payment to the owner of the machine in the first place. He can only get his profit by paying the workers less than what the workers are contributing to the production process. So the problem here, which was pointed out by the great Austrian economist, von Balber, is that if that's true, if rate of profit depends on how much labor is employed, not on how much capital is in the particular type of work, then industries with a lot of labor and little capital should earn a higher rate of profit than those with a lot of fixed capital and not that much labor. But in fact, average profit for each industry tends to be the same. You could see why that would have to be true, that they, if some industries were earning a lot more profit than others, then investors would just go into that more profitable industry and drive down the rate of profit until it was no more than the average. So Marx was certainly aware of that. He tried to work on this in the second and third volumes of major work, Das Kapital. The only volume that Marx published in his lifetime was the first volume, came out in 1867, but it was the second and third volume that he was in manuscript and was published after his death by Friedrich Engels. So Marx was aware of this problem, that profit should depend on the amount of labor in a particular industry, which was called the variable capital, but instead profit is the same for all industries. It doesn't vary with the amount of labor, as the theory says. So Marx is aware of that, but von Balber pointed out that Marx couldn't solve the problem. So another problem for the theory is that Marx held that as capital investment increases, the rate of profit will fall. And you can see why is this true, because remember, according to Marx, profit depends just on the amount of labor that's used in a particular industry. So if the investment in capital goods increases, then the rate of profit is going to be going down, but that hasn't been borne out by the fact. And Marx also thought that the worker's position would keep getting worse, but the problem there that Rothbard points out is if they earn subsistence wages, how can it get worse? You can't go below subsistence. And I see that there's a question from A.L. Spencer. All capitalists paid only subsistence wages. Who's going to purchase the product? Yes, that's also a very good problem for this account. So, okay, well, I think we'll stop now. There's a lot more could be said about Marx's economic theory, but I think those are some of the basics. So we can go to question. I'll put, let me see, is there a, let me just see here, I'll open the Q&A also if you want to be in that, but you can type your questions in the chat or the Q&A, whichever you prefer, but I'll put the open the Q&A one also and then open the chat. So we can have anything you want to discuss here. Questions? Thank you. Bob says, how do contemporary Marxists deal with these problems? That's a very interesting question. I'm glad you asked that, because I wrote a book about that. Now, there some Marxists who are called the analytical Marxists say, they want to throw out certain parts of Marxism, like the labor theory of value, say, we can kind of come up with a different sort of system that retains Marx's conclusion, but gets rid of some of these problems. And I don't think they've been very successful. Now, there are other Marxists who can reinterpret what Marx was saying. For example, they say, he wasn't really committed to a strict subsistence theory of wages. He could recognize that wages are in large part socially determined. So people's, what workers would get would depend on what the kind of expected standard of life in a particular society. You see, the problem, if you say that, then it weakens the argument for revolution, because the Marxist argument for revolution is workers are going to get worse and worse, and things are going to get so bad they'll just overthrow the system. But it isn't clear why, if you take the interpretation that says they're not workers aren't earning, but can earn more than strict subsistence, then you say, how do you know they're going to revolt? And now, as to this contradiction that von Bobert pointed out, there have been various ways people try to deal with that. They'll say, if you can kind of perform certain calculations, you can show that, maybe you could show that if you sum up all the profit the different industries are making, you might get, and then sum up all the amounts of labor, you can generate certain kinds of relationships between the two quantities. But even if you accepted that, it would really be abandoning the basic point that profit is supposed to depend just on amount of labor rather than on total capital outlay. If you could generate some kind of formulas that show there were certain relationships between labor and profit, it wouldn't be clear what the significance of that was. Now, there's other people, somewhat Marxist, father of the Italian economist Piero Sraffa, S-R-A-F-F-A, who have kind of a different system that's supposed to avoid this problem. This problem is called the transformation problem. They have a different system that's trying to avoid that. But then it's questionable whether that could be called the Marxist system. Okay, now let's see something else here. Bob says, I have friends in Berlin that live right off Karl Marx Allee, major thoroughfare. There's a statue of Marx, too. He seems to be quite venerated. It's on the old East Berlin side. It's interesting. Well, I mean, they still have in England, in Highgate Cemetery, they have Marx's grave with, I think there's a bust of Marx in there. So, I mean, there are people who still think highly of Marx. I like to say, I know some Marx, but I don't know all the angles. I think I used that one before. Now, Matthew says, why did Marx use the term communism rather than socialism? Is there a difference between the two at all? This is a rather disputed topic. Marx thought that after we had the socialist revolution, after the overthrow of capitalism, there'll be an initial stage in which people will follow, there'll be payments made to workers on the basis of what they produce. So there'll be an initial stage where people will still be getting, will be paid a certain amount of wages, and it'll still retain certain features from capitalism. There'll be certain emphasis on productivity. Incentives might still have to be in operation to get people produced. But then, as the system develops further, then we'll have total abundance. People will just start producing so much. And then Marx says, in socialism, you have the system will be an equal days pay for an equal day's work, so it'll be kind of somewhat of an equality of labor. But under this system of abundance, then we'll have a new system from each according to its ability, his ability to each according to his need. So everybody will just produce things freely, we'll have total abundance, you can take whatever you want. Now, sometimes the term communism is used for the higher stage, but that's mainly a later usage that comes in during the 20th century. Marx tends to use the term socialism and communism somewhat indifferently. So I don't think for Marx there's really that much of a difference. There is this notion to say, Bob said, did Marx see the problem with economic calculation? No, he didn't. He tended to say very little, if anything, about how a socialist society would be organized. Engels did address the problem, and he thought there was a calculation problem. Rothbard has some quotations from him saying he was quite aware of there'd be a problem of setting prices for goods, but somehow he thought that would be a reason we're trying to set up socialism too fast might not work. But somehow he thought, he isn't clear why he thought that could be solved under the socialist revolution. He really didn't have an answer for that. But so he pointed out the problem himself somehow, but he didn't really give an answer for it. But he was aware of it. Sometimes the Marxists think, they think if you have a scientific system, you don't really need to have a price system. There are various attempts by socialist economists to answer Mises has a basic argument that economic calculation requires a price system. Remember, this came out in his article in 1920. There are various attempts by socialist economists to answer him. But Marx himself, I think, really didn't address the problem Engels referred to as aware of it, but didn't have an answer either. let me hear something. Steve, in some modern Marxists try to explain the heart of the communist Soviet Union at 1930s, China in the 1950s, Cambodia in 1970s, simply temporary raw communism before it develops into socialism. Well, they don't usually use this term raw communism, but there have been some people have said, well, according to Marxism, the social system doesn't get transformed into a new system until the full productive potential of the old system is exhausted. So, say, feudalism wasn't replaced by capitalism until economic production reached its limits under feudalism. So, some people, not the one who established the communist regimes, but some people said, well, if you try to establish socialism before capitalism is fully developed, then you're going to have all sorts of problems. It won't work. So they're, say, the Mensheviks, who proposed the Bolsheviks, said, well, what we need in Russia is not socialism. We have to have capitalism developed to its full amount. So some people have tried to say, well, the reason for all these horrors of communism, a reason for it is that they would violate, the people who put these into practice were violating communist theory by trying to put in socialist revolution too prematurely. Now, at the same time, can we say that Marx neglected individuals' behavior in his theory for a great deal? Well, I think he did tend to have aspects of his theory that were opposed to methodological individualism. He would sometimes did deal with individuals and their motives, but he did deal with these things like force of production and tend to view something operating independently of individuals. Now, I should say, there's one writer, Marx, Jan Elster, E-L-S-T-E-R, who thinks, this is kind of perhaps an unusual view, he thinks Marx was a methodological individualist. So he would reject the certain criticism I've been giving, but that requires him to get rid of a lot of Marxism saying that. So I would say, in my view, there are key parts of Marx's theory that were not in accord with methodological individualism. So to that extent, I think you're right that Marx wasn't considering individuals' behavior as the primary factor. He seems to be thinking this force of production was really developed independently of individuals. Do you have a favorite anti-Marxist movie, pro-Marxist? I don't think so. I'm not really that up on movies. I like the pro-Marx, but I like the Marx Brothers movies. That doesn't have much to do with communism, but I'm not really up on movies. I'm sorry. I have movies I like, but not on that theme. I thought Young Frankenstein was a very good movie. Blazing Saddles. Those are good ones. Now, Steve says, how did Marxism, based on labor theory, value, survive the development of subjection, marginal utility theory, mainly in general, the 1870s? Well, the Marxists just went their own way, and they just didn't accept the subjective theory. They went on with their own theories. There were attempts, I don't think very successful, by Marxists like Rudolf Hilferding and Nikolai Bukharin to reply to von Bavinck's criticism of Marx, but they just basically ignored the marginal utility school. They said this is just apologetics for capitalism. Remember I mentioned we had the Marxist thought that the social theories are ideological, they're just part of the superstructure. So they said, well, this theory, marginal utility theory, is just an attempt to find some kind of justification for capitalism within the capitalist interest. Now, there were a few attempts at kind of trying to come up with a subjective value theory that it used subjective value theory and still come up with socialist arguments, like the great playwright, Irish playwright George Bernard Shaw accepted the subjective theory of value as a very strong socialist. In fact, Philip Wicksteed was one of the great pioneers of subjectivist economics, was also sympathetic to socialism. So basically the Marxists just said the subjective theory wrong. Steve, is that above not what you see today? Oh yes, I think I covered that question already. Oh, here's another one. In von Bauer's words on Marx and comments, if you think that Marx is gene, he doesn't really elaborate what he thinks of. Do you believe there are any strong aspects in Marx's work? Well, I mean, Marx certainly knew an enormous amount. He had, I mean, there are all sorts of interesting arguments, and I don't think, I think in volumes two, Line of Robinson, volumes 2 and 3 of Capital, Marx had interesting things to say on how capital circulates from one industry to another, but I'm not really up on exactly how he does that. I mean, I think it's obvious when you read Marx, he was an extremely smart person. I don't think any of his fundamental theories really hold up all that much. I mean, he was certainly not, he was no dummy. I mean, but I think one, of course, one reason von Bauer wants to say Marx is a genius is that, well, suppose you have somebody who's a genius and then you've refuted him, then that makes you pretty good also. So I think von Bauer thinks wants to make Marx, kind of elevate Marx so he can kind of knock him down and he'd look better. Here's something. He says, as I see here and there some of the basic ideas in social labor theory of value, my friend leaves not knowing the name of it. In your opinion, these are residuals of socialist thought or socialism was grown on these kind of public ideas. Because I think certain of the social, I'm not sure I'm understanding your question. I think if you mean that certain ideas of Marxism kind of become very popular and people take some of them for granted today, even though they're not Marxist, I think that's certainly the case. I mean, say we have particular, say, we have a picture, many people have a picture of the early stage of capitalism, industrial revolution is very bad for the workers. And a lot of that view stems from Marx's account of capitalism in Das Kapital. So I think a lot of people absorb certain Marxist views even though they don't realize that's the source of them. Let's see here. Are there any prominent Marxist critique of fractional reserve banking or free banking? I'm not aware of anything like that. I think Marx have things to say about the banking system, but as Rothbard points out, he tended not to ascribe primary importance to banks as creator of money, or kind of a follower of the banking school in that respect. And Steve says, would you really, Marx started with the conclusion he wanted the evils of capitalism to develop a theoretical structure to lead to this end? I would think that's a plausible way. I mean, if you read Rothbard, Marx had kind of a certain philosophical views that were quasi-religious or extremely hostile to the development of capitalism and individualism. So I think in his scientific work, he was trying to give kind of establish some basis for his philosophical ideas. I mean, I don't think you could view him just kind of a objective scientist and just say, well, I just happened to have turned up these facts about the development of capitalism. I'm not having any particular ideological value judgments on it. That's just how it happens to turn out. I don't think that would be plausible to see Marx that way. Well, thanks everybody for coming to the lecture. I think we're about out of time now. So hope to see you next week. Thanks everybody. Steve says, can you direct this to any literature addressing how economies recover from communism? Well, I think Rothbard has some things about that in his volume Economic Controversies. I think he has a couple essays on that. So if you look at Rothbard Economic Controversies, I'd recommend that. Okay, thanks everybody. Bye.